Well, Jesse, what they came to you about, you were the secretary then, not the lady.
Well, now you want to do this?
Okay.
Yep. Well, at the end of 2 years, I had become very friendly with the secretary of the Consumers League of Washington. And, of course, I knew the Consumers League background from Boston because that was one of the finest Consumers Leagues they had. And I admired them. I knew the work they were doing. I knew their whole story, the background and everything. And so, finally, this woman decided she had to go somewhere, or there was some reason why she couldn't carry on, they offered me the job. And as I remembered, I think I was getting $1,500 or $1,800 a year for it. And of course I had my own office, and I had an executive committee like all organizations. I was the paid employee of it. And they got up meetings, and I got up meetings, and we raised money and so on. And then finally the question came up of getting a minimum wage law through the United States Congress, because the Congress governed Washington, and although the number of employees in Washington was not large, and the number being exploited, they were being exploited all right, but there weren't any great factories and industry. There were just the laundries and the stores and the restaurants. And so they decided. The gold marks, the two gold marks, were sisters-in-laws of Justice Brandeis. And so they got together with Justice Brandeis and drafted the law. And as it happened, the man that we got to introduce it into the lower house of the Senate was Congressman Keating from Pueblo, Colorado, from where I came. He knew my family, and I had never met him. But Keating was a very broad-minded legislator, one of very rare men that had social conscience and understood the background of the minimum wage law. And he jumped at the chance to introduce it into the lower house. And we got Senator Hollis to introduce it in the Senate. And he was very close to the president of the United States at that time, and the Democrats were in ruling, of course. The Senate was Democratic because the President was a Democrat, and so he, Senator Hollis, introduced it into the United States Senate. And so there we were. The law was now introduced, and it was my job now to go up to the Capitol. The money for my salary and keep the Consumers League going financially, but I had to get up to the Capitol at once and start it on its journey through the Congress.
Now, what did you do exactly then?
Well, the first man that had to be consulted was Congressman Ben Johnson of Kentucky, who was chairman of the district committee, and he was an old bear. He loathed women around. He loathed advanced ideas about things like minimum wage and women getting a living wage. And in fact, he was a heartbreak of the whole of the city of Washington, because no decent enlightened legislation for Washington could get through Ben Johnson. It was just impossible to get anything through. And so I remember the day that Pauline Goldmark said, "What are you going to do about Ben Johnson? And how are you going to get around him?" They seemed to think somehow maybe I'd find a way, but they weren't sure. So I remember the day that I called on him in his office. And you must remember that we had no woman suffrage then. And women were not supposed to go up into the office building of either the House or Senate. And nothing irritated those men more than to hear our heels clicking along those marble corridors. There were women up there working quietly in offices, but to have lobbyists up there calling on them with the status of a lobbyist was just like a red flag to a bull. So I remember I had a cute little dress. It was red and white little fine checks, you know, and we used to always wear those check dresses. And it had a ruffle right down the front, and I had it starched. And and I had it on fresh and was severely starched and just standing out, looking very gay, when I walked into Congressman Ben Johnson's office. And he was in the back office, so I went to the door at his office and I said, "Congressman, may I please speak to you for a few minutes?" And I was very courteous, and he was sitting at his desk, and he looked up and he said, "What are you doing here? Why aren't you home having babies where you belong?" And I knew the fate of our minimum wage bill hung on my answer. And I said, "Well, Congressman," in a soft tone, "you see, it's an awkward situation. You're supposed to have a husband before you have a baby. And I haven't got a husband." "Well, why don't you get one?" he said. "Well," I said, "Congressman, I would like one, but you see, so far, all the good ones are already married." Well, of course, he was already married, too, so, "Oh," he said, "that's rough." His voice changed his tone, and he said, "Well, come on and sit down and tell me what I can do for you. I'll have to help you, I can see that." And I said, "Yes, Congressman, I do need help." And so I started talking to him about this minimum wage bill and the women down in the 5 and 10 cent store downtown that were getting $4 a week and having to either live on their families or live with a man. And we wanted to change that. And he said, "Well," he said, "what can I do for you?" "Well, Congressman," I said, "if you just set a date for the hearing, I will see that the leading employers of the stores are there, because I happen to know Edward Killeen from Boston, and he's now in town, and he has this huge store, and he's also been president of the International Businessmen's Association. He's widely known." And I said, "Congressman, if I can get him to appear at your hearing, and these leading store men, I'll get you on the front page of every newspaper in Washington. How would you like that?" "Well," he said, "that would be all right. When do you want your date?" And he set the date. And I walked right downtown in this gay mood I was in at this point, and there was Edward Killeen, and he said, "I would be honored to speak at your hearing." And I walked right back to the congressman, and I said, "He's coming." "Well," he said, "this begins to look interesting." And we had the hearing, and it was jammed of the leading employers of Washington. And Edward Killeen made the first speech, and it was gorgeous. And he told them how it paid to pay women well. They brought in the business, and that's what you're after, is business. And a well-paid, happy, gay, well cared for, well fed clerk in your store brings in the business. And they saw that point.
Now, was this minimum wage for just women, or was
just women? Well, it's never been for the men, of course, in all those areas were organized there, but there were no women's organizations at all. And not one woman would have ever gotten a job in Washington if she'd belonged to a clerk's organization, a labor organization. I've forgotten how long he was. It was no time till he had that through the House. They couldn't believe it. Florence Kelly, of course, came down and spoke. And they just couldn't believe it, that this thing they had fought and struggled for with such anguish would just fly through. So I went up to him afterwards and thanked him. And he said, "Miss Haver," he said, "I have a lot of influence around here." "Oh, Congressman," I said, "that's why I came to you first. We all know that." "Well," he said, "if there's ever anything you want around here, just let me know, and I'm at your service." So with that, I bade him goodbye and beat it over to the Senate. And Senator Hollis said, "We can't get that bill when it comes up before a committee unless you can get Reed Smoot to okay it."
Now, who was that?
Well, Reed Smoot was also the most difficult man in the United States Senate. He was head of the Rules Committee. He sat right down on the center aisle, and not a single bill could go anywhere unless he okayed it. And it was at a time when Pendergast, one of the worst politicians from Pennsylvania that ever was in the United States Senate, was practically running the Senate. It was a very terrible situation there for any kind of legislation at all. It was a corrupt, one of the most corrupt Senates they ever had. So anyway, the thing to do was call on Reed Smoot. And the president of the Consumers League, Mrs. Edward Costigan, whose husband was head of the Tariff Commission in Washington and had been the governor of Colorado, Mrs. Senator and Mrs. Edward Costigan. And she was now president of our Consumers League. So they decided that she had better go with me to call on Reed Smoot. I don't know whether they thought he was going to chop my head off. I knew he wasn't, because Reed Smoot was from Salt Lake City and was a Mormon. That's Salt Lake City, isn't it? One of the leading Mormons. A very high-grade man, a gentleman, tall, handsome man. So anyway, Mrs. Costigan, who was a very lovely, sweet, gracious woman, and I descended on his office. We had an appointment. And we came in, and he was there, and he rose from his desk, and, "How do you do, ladies?" And he had a seat at one side of his desk for me and one for Mrs. Costigan. And I said, "Senator, we have come up to talk to you about this minimum wage bill, you know. It's now gone through the House, and so, of course, we look forward to you to help get it through the Senate." Whereupon he rose from his desk, and he began to pound his desk so that everything on his desk danced. And he said, "You women," he said, "with all this socialistic legislation," he said, "you know what? I'd like to be president of this United States when all this legislation gets in there." He said, "I'd just like to be president. Then you could be the greatest dictator you ever saw with this kind of legislation coming up." And Mrs. Costigan commenced to tremble, you know, and looked at him with horror, and the desk was dancing with the objects on it. And I just looked at him and smiled sweetly, and I said, "You know, Senator, I wish you could be President of the United States." "Well," he said, and he sat down with a bump, "why would you like to see me as President?" You see, that wasn't a very smart remark. I knew he was dying to be President, and he was capable of being President. He was a very great legislator, but he was a Mormon. And at that time, our country was a little stuffy about appointing people with such a strong strong religious background as that. They were a little stuffy about appointing them. So he said, "Would you like to see me as president?" "Why," I said, "you see, Senator, if you were president on issues like this, you just have to look at both sides of the question, and you're not used to doing that." "Well," he said, "what do you want me to do then?" And I said, "Well, when that bill comes in, would you just pick up your things and leave your seat till we can get it into Senator Hollis's committee?" He said, "All right, I'll be glad to do it. I'm glad to have met you, ladies." And we shook hands and left. And Mrs. Costigan could hardly walk out of the room. She was so frightened at what had happened. But everything was all right. And in no time, Senator Hollis had a hearing that was equally impressive. We didn't have to work so hard for it, because he was a very generous and enlightened man from New Hampshire and one of the great leaders of the United States Senate. And the bill got through, and the president signed it in 6 weeks instead of 2 years.
So that was 6 months. The first major piece of legislation that you lobbied on that.
Well, that was you see, in the process, you have to remember that you've just got to live up at that Capitol. And I was there in that Senate gallery for weeks watching them in and studying it. You've got to really get that whole mechanism into your system. But I never loved anything in my life. I was completely fulfilled, and as a woman even, I was just completely, everything I had in me I was using and using effectively. I didn't know where it came from, but that was the story.
Were there other women lobbyists?
Just very few, and they were the suffrage lobbyists.
Oh, they were all the suffrage.
Oh, yes. And in the process then, of course, Alice Paul was carrying on her picketing the White House against the law of the city. And Mrs. Carrie Chapman Catt was living in the big hotel down on Pennsylvania Avenue, and all her cohorts were calling on Senator from Idaho that was stalling the bill after all these years, Senator Borah, B-O-R-A-H-A, he was, and they were just living up there at the Capitol, lobbying, but not many of them were there. I didn't see them very often. I ate down in the dining room where all the guests were eating, and the senators were all there, and I got to know a lot of them, and I went to the hearings. But then, right in the midst of that, that's when I discovered the hearings on the meatpacking industry.
That was after the minimum wage law was passed?
Or it was no, it was still hanging fire. And you want me to go on with that? Well, I was clicking along the corridor there one day, and I think this was in the House. And as I remembered, it hadn't got into the Senate yet. And I saw a door open, and I looked in the room, and it was a hearing going on, a long table, and the congressmen were there at the table, and a man was sitting at the end of the table speaking, and evidently, and I knew instantly it was the meatpackers' hearing, because they were publishing at that time huge pages in the Washington Post and the Evening Star, flattering pages about their great skill as meatpackers. And so there wasn't a sound of the hearings in any papers, and certainly not in those papers. As far as I know, none of the outside city. I don't know how far their advertising was going, but I was mad at the time because it was the most brazen advertising I'd ever seen for a big industry. It was obvious they had a lot at stake. I didn't know what it was they had at stake, but I was just subconsciously interested because, of course, I'd been for several years on a ranch south of Pueblo when my father had gone into the cattle business of raising cattle out on the range and riding out in the midst of terrible thunderstorms, snowstorms, as they were in Colorado, and hunting up the cattle, his cows, and getting the fences mended, and it's a horrible life for, and my father was not highly educated, but he was basically a cultured man. He wasn't one of these tough old cattle men that could stand that kind of life. And so I knew about that. So anyway, on this particular day, I just dropped in, and I got out my pencil because it happened that was one of the days that the armor packing company had cornered rice and made a huge fortune out of it because the women were all told to buy rice instead of potatoes because the war was on and they had to have the potatoes for the men in the army here and abroad. And so when I got this story of this rice, I beat it down to the woman editor of the Christian Science Monitor. And eventually, I'll think of her name, she was a very great newspaper woman, but they weren't there. There were no newspapers there. And I showed her the story. I'd copied it as it was revealed that day. And I said, look, Vera, you must report this hearing. This is hot stuff. So she took it and sent it to the Monitor, and it came out on the front page as her story, of course. And, of course, immediately all the other newspapers saw it there. And so the next day, I had 10 women in there with nice little pencils and notes.
Now, were they from the Consumers League?
Yeah, they were my nice Consumers League, including Mrs. Costigan and the board members And I called them all up and I said, this is a terrible story and this is a consumer story and has to do with women, and you must get down there. So there they were. Well, when all those women filed in, you ought to have seen the expression on the faces, especially of the man that was a district attorney back in Chicago, was brought there to protect these men and run this hearing. And the expression on the faces of all of them, of these women with their notes, taking down notes, was just cataclysmic. And after that, of course, I had a meeting of the Consumers League, and they reported what they heard, and we began filling that hearing room with an audience all the time, while I was still lobbying for the minimum wage law. And everybody got excited, and finally, I persuaded Mrs. Kelly to come down and testify. But she was very unwilling to do it because it was really not their field. Their field was women in industry, women's wages, and to get off into this great monopoly of the meat packers was just something that she didn't want to do, had never done. But by Jove, she got down there. And of course, that upset them terribly. They knew who Florence Kelly was, don't worry. And we got there's a lot of publicity on it. So that the whole thing broke. And then I made a business of attending the hearings every day and writing up what I heard. And I got them to to the Christian Science Monitor. And then there was another brilliant newspaper man on the United Press. And his stories went out of Washington. And he was very enlightened and brilliant newspaper man, very famous. His name, of course, has just gone from me now. And I got the stories to him, and he commenced sending them out through the UP all over the country. And so the advertising stopped because the thing had broken loose, you see, and we could get the publicity was going out. And so eventually then Alice Paul and her crowd were getting more and more violent, and I don't know that the president was burned in effigy, but I remember he was. I find no record of it. I don't think people like to publish it, probably. I know that soon after that, he served notice on the United States Senate. He was coming up to speak on the woman suffrage amendment. And he was really in a boat because all his speeches were about getting freedom for mankind, and yet here were the women couldn't get freedom. He didn't want to give that. He didn't want to endorse that woman suffrage. But he saw that he couldn't carry on anymore.
Well, Jesse, this Maud Younger was the lobbyist for the National Woman's Party, wasn't she? Do you remember that name? Did you know her as a lobbyist?
No, I don't. I remember the name, but I don't remember her as a lobbyist.
No, so the National...
the woman that whose husband founded the Food and Drug Administration, Harvey Wiley, was the leading lobbyist. Mrs. Harvey Wiley.
Well, that was
and Mrs. William Kent. Mrs. William Kent's husband was on the Tariff Commission, and they were from California. And William Kent had brought this issue of this monopoly into Washington. He was responsible. And his wife was one of the leading lobbyists and one of the ones that had forced feeding. And so was Mrs. Whose name I've just said.
Wiley.
Yeah, Harvey Wiley had forced feeding. They were about, Alice Paul never did get into prison. All her little pals did, but she didn't. But she got them there, and she got them to picketing the White House and writing their speeches and writing what they were to say and what they were doing. She had gone to London originally and gotten trained by Mrs. Pankhurst. So she was really what you would call an extremist on this subject, at least with the other women called her an extremist.
Now, the National Consumers League, though, their concern was primarily with women, with working women.
And wages, the conditions and security and safety of working women. That was their ball. And Mrs. Florence Kelly was very unhappy at going down there and speaking at this. I don't know how I ever forced her, persuaded her to do it. She did not do it happily, because it was out of their line. It's a wonder she ever did. And she didn't carry too much weight. But just ordinary women coming in there did, you see. And the monitor carried a lot of weight.
Now, when was it... So that occurred during the lobbying for the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember when, in all of that, you went to New Jersey to take on that job to see what working conditions were like? Was that after that?
No, it was a number of years before that. It was soon after I... got interested in the minimum wage in Washington. I was living in Washington when I did that, and it was soon after I got interested in the minimum wage for women. And suddenly I heard about that strike up in New Jersey, and so I think I used a holiday, or it took me 2 or 3 weeks to do it.
And it was while you were as the Secretary of the Consumers League already.
I was still Secretary of the Consumers League. And Harry Laidler, L-I-L-A-I-D-L-E-R, he was then Secretary of some consumer organization in New York City. But he was very much interested in minimum wage and all those issues, see. So he knew that I was doing that. Now, do you want to know the story of that? Well, I just went up to the Botany Mills in New Jersey. They weren't right in Paterson, as I remember it. And got a room and found out how you got a job there. And I went out early one morning, and it was terribly snowy. The ground was covered with snow, and there was no way to get there except to walk 2 or 3 from the town where people lived. The factory was way out where they lived, and nobody had horses or cars. It was another world from this, and you just had to walk out there. It was a terrible experience just to walk there and get there. But I got a job instantly, and I was given to one of their crack weavers. A marvelous, clever woman, and she at once took an interest in me and just took me over as if I were her little assistant, and taught me how to run these great weaving machines. And I remember that, how did we eat out there? They had lunchrooms, but they were very ordinary. The restrooms were terrible, and the whole environment. And then there wasn't any light. There were the solid brick walls, so that when you got out there before the sun was up, and you got out of there at night when the sun was gone, you never saw daylight at all. That's what killed me. I thought I'd die.
Was there
to go
5 days?
Yes, I don't remember being cold in there, but also you had to stand, you see, for hours. There's no place to sit down, even. That was a terrible thing. And there was something terrible about the eating. You had to stand in line for a chance to get in there to eat. And there was nothing done to make you take the ache out of your body from the standing at these great... And then the noise of these machines is something terrible. While I was there, one of the other men weavers on the other side came over to her and asked her if she thought that maybe he could get me for a wife. He said she looks like she'd be a good wife. And he asked my teacher, you see, he said, what should he do? He thought I looked like I'd be a good wife, and how did she think that he could get acquainted with me? And so she discouraged him. I told her she better just discourage him. And she was very suspicious of me. She sensed that I wasn't of the same breed that they all were, but she loved me. She thought I was just lovely. And she said, I tried so hard, but she didn't think I'd ever become as skilled as she was, because I just didn't seem to see I hadn't got manual dexterity in my hands. And so she helped me all she could. And I worked there 2 weeks, but I thought I'd die. I never went through such a terrible experience.
Then did you write articles about it?
So then I wrote an article about it for Harry Laidler, and and he published it. And it went all over the East, that article. He didn't put my name on it. I asked him not to. But it created a complete change in the whole knitting industry of New Jersey, that story. It went all over the place, encouraged people to know that those girls needed either a minimum wage or labor unions. And it created, I think it created, one of the worst strikes they'd ever had, that story, after it got out. He got it into the right press. Mm-hmm. And after that story, and I just told everything that was wrong with it, you see, and the horrible business of walking out to that factory, and why they didn't get streetcars to come out there and bring those people out, you see. And it created, I'll tell you something funny about me, I suddenly step into something and something happens. I don't know why, just something happens. And he sent me the story of the result of that. And he said I was responsible for it.
So then you went back to Washington. This was just while you were actually
Oh, yes,
working.
And I didn't tell anybody what I'd been doing.
Oh, no one knew?
No, nobody knew where I was or anything. And I couldn't understand why I'd done such a crazy thing, and it was a risky thing to do, and to wonder I ever got away with it. And physically, it took me quite a long time to recover the effect of it.
But you felt, in other words, that you wanted to see this firsthand.
Yes, I just wanted to see what it was like and what it felt like to work in a situation like that. And the woman who taught me was the principal teacher, and she was sweet. But what she had gone through physically for that job was something terrible. And she told me, she said, you know, out here we don't last long, we just die. I haven't very many more years. I won't last long either. This kills us, and we know it. We aren't here very long. We just plain die. And of course they had no medical care. They had no fringe benefits. They had nothing. I don't think they had any holiday pays or anything else. Nothing could have been worse than the labor situation in that factory. You just couldn't have had it worse. And I got all of it. I got the whole story.
Now, then, after the meatpacking hearings, was there other legislation that you were lobbying?
No, then after the while the meatpacking hearings were still going on, President Woodrow Wilson spoke, and at last this suffrage amendment went through. And the news came out that Carrie Chapman Catt with her party of speakers were going to start through the far West to hurry up the ratification. They felt in the West where a lot of the states already had woman suffrage and where they were sympathetic to it, that she could hurry up the ratification. Now at last, after 50 years, she got it through the Congress. And so her hotel was just across the street from the Muncie Building where I worked. So I barged into her office one night about 5 o'clock, said I had heard she was going, and I told her what I'd been doing. On the getting the story out on the meatpacking industry and why I was interested in it. And I said, I wish I could go with you on this tour and instead of talking woman suffrage, tell about this meatpacking industry as one of the industries that women are concerned with as buyers of food, and I would talk on that. And of course, Mrs. Catt's first reaction was against it because she felt that if the big industries thought that the motors were going to stick their noses into something like these monopolies that were now still very common, they'd see to it they didn't get the vote yet. So she was uneasy about it. So, being a great diplomat, she said, well, Jesse, it'd be fun to have you go with us, but we couldn't afford to take you. And I said, well, how much would it cost? And she said, well, it would cost $500. And I said, if I can get the $500, can I go? And she said, well, yes, if you can get $500. So I went out and up to William Kent's office up on New York Avenue and told him that, and I said, she'll be in every 6 states of the West, and I'll speak right from the same platform with her, and I'll tell this meatpacking story. I want to go. So she says, I have to have $500. So he just pulled out his checkbook and put it on the desk, wrote the $500, and in half an hour I was back with $500. And she said, well, Jesse, she said, I promised you you could go. You've got the $500. So I guess we better take you along.
Now, had you ever met her before, Jesse?
No.
Or was that the first time you met her?
Yeah, never met her before.
So did
I'd heard her speak many times. And I saw that she was a very great leader, and she was a parliamentarian. She didn't believe in getting things done except through the democratic parliamentary procedure, and she didn't think that picketing and burning in effigy and all those things had anything to do with the parliamentary procedure. They were the kind of things that revolutionists used, and they were not the kind of things that a democracy should use to get its will done. The only thing it could do was to get the legislative process through the legislative process and the government process, and she believed in that. So that put her in a field antagonistic to Alice Paul and all those other women. She was just antagonistic to that, and she thought it violated our democratic procedure, and I agreed with her, all painful as it was for all those years. I have somewhere exactly the whole record as she wrote it out. Have I said that record to you? Her record, Mrs. Katz's record. Close it off.
Jesse, did you leave your, when you went on the tour then, did you resign from your job at the National Consumers League, or did you keep your job?
I think that would have been rather brave to resign, don't you?
Now, growing out of the meatpacking hearings. Mm-hmm.
Right. Growing out of the meatpacking hearings, which broke into the press all over the United States until the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, got wind of it. And the result was that he created the Federal Trade Commission, because without some restraint, great industries would go on creating these great monopolies, as the meat packers had done so successfully, and it would have strangled free competition, which America stands for, and the right of the individual to be free in his own industry. An interesting thing about it is that the Armour was the only one of the five packers that had a soul, you might say, if that's a big way to put it. The others were ruthless, hard-boiled butchers. But Armour was sensitive, and he hadn't known all this was going on. And he became very ill, and after the thing blew up and the meatpackers were condemned for what they'd done by the Congress, and Woodrow Wilson had formed this Federal Trade Commission to keep this kind of thing from ever happening again, Woodrow Armour went to England for his health and died there. Curiously enough, by that time I was in England, and I hadn't been there very long when he arrived there and passed away. But of course he had no idea that the person that had helped bring about this disaster was also there but not dying. So that Woodrow Wilson really stopped for all time any more such monopolies as the meatpacking industry had been, and as other big companies might have tempted to do without restriction. And so it just shows to those who hear this story that in our democracy we have still the power of the individual. Just one person really started and blew that story open. Always takes often more than one person. And I remember about that time my husband met Senator Borah one day out in front of Washington's railway station. He was sitting there resting, and my husband sat down with him, and he said, Senator Borah, do you think that a democracy can ever be efficient? And Senator Borah said, no, it will never be efficient, but it can carry on. But he said, a dictatorship can't be efficient, because then they wouldn't last. They would get blown up. Whereas a democracy can carry on, it can afford to make mistakes and still be alive. So that's the conclusion of that great experience with the meatpacking industry. And it's a nice story to remember because it shows how much power we always will have in America as individuals. And if things need correction, we have at our fingertips the machinery to bring about that correction if we will just get alert, stop being apathetic, and do something about it. And this gives us enthusiasm and courage.